Hello and welcome to Audio Readers Sports Show. My name's Jane Woods. Today we'll start our program with Sports Illustrated. Last week we were reading Paradise Squashed by L. John Wertheim. In the 90s, life was a breeze for the masterminds behind a site called World Sports Exchange from Antigua. They were pioneering internet sports betting. Then, the NFL rallied the U.S. government against them. This is a story about three young men, Cohen, Schillinger, and Ware, who started their careers on Wall Street and then moved from stock exchanges to trading bets. They are the founders of the World Sports Exchange, WSEX, which began advertising in the United States in 1990s and then became a worldwide betting center that caught the eye of the NFL. At the time, the NFL retained two main law firms, Debevoise and Plimpton in New York, and Covington and Burling, the former firm of Tagliabue, in Washington, D.C. In addition to these law firms, the NFL also had an ally in the U.S. Senate. John Kyle introduced the Internet Gambling Prohibition Act. In March of 1998, Mary Jo White, chief U.S. attorney for the Southern District, based in Manhattan, acted on the case of the NFL lawyers at Debevoise and charged 21 bet takers, including our founders, Cohen, Schillinger, and Ware, with violating the Federal Wire Act through their involvement in offshore betting operations. We left off last broadcast with the founders making a plan, as the front-facing figure Cohen would return to the United States and let Ware and Schillinger, who were more operational, continue to run the business. Cohen either would fight the indictment or call the U.S. government on a bluff. Then he'd come back to Antigua, and they would celebrate. That was the intent. In March of 1998, Cohen left for New York, where he turned himself in to the FBI, and then hired prominent defense lawyer Benjamin Braffman to represent him. Braffman was coming off a successful defense of notorious Manhattan club promoter Peter Gaddion against a series of federal charges. Cohen recalls Braffman assuring him the Gaddion case was a stretch on the part of the federal government. This case is an even greater stretch. Good, Cohen said, because he had no intention of pleading guilty. I told him, Ben, you'll not hear the word guilty roll off my tongue. 'Cause I did nothing wrong. I don't care if they kick it down to a parking ticket. I was very explicit about that. But after 10 days, before a jury in court in February of 2000, Cohen became the first person to be convicted on federal charges of running an illegal offshore internet sporting gambling operation. He was sentenced to nearly 2 years in prison. An internet communication is no different than a telephone for purposes of liability under the Wire Wager Act. White told reporters following the verdict, none of the other 21 defendants went to trial. But as internet speeds got ever faster and sports fans grew ever more intoxicated by betting online, especially during games, WSEX's business continued booming. Cohen may have been convicted, but prosecutors could not simply stop a company in Antigua from operating. In 2001, it was the subject of a fairly glowing 60 Minutes profile that deemed the company more reliable than your local bookie and a lot cheaper than flying to Vegas. In 2003, WSEX was the internet's most popular and profitable online gambling site. Fugitives by choice, Ware and Schillinger joked about being trapped in paradise. but it was less than ideal. When Ware's older brother got married, Hayden, fearful of returning to the U.S. and risking arrest, could only listen to the ceremony from Antigua, through a cell phone in the groom's pocket. Schillinger had moved to the Caribbean with his wife and two children, but his family moved back to the U.S. without him. Eventually, his wife filed for divorce. "We went from having this cool adventure," Ware says, "to being exiles." Meanwhile, Cohen mounted an appeal. His lawyers made the case that the Wire Act, conceived decades before the Internet, was never meant to apply to online transactions. Since the WSEX servers were Antigua, that's where the bets were being made, and the U.S. was interfering with the rules of a sovereign country. "The Internet," Braffman said, "isn't owned by anyone." Cohen, though, lost his appeal. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear his case in June of 2002. He began his 18-month stint that October in the minimum security Nellis Federal Prison Camp, which ironically sits amid Nevada scrub 25 miles north of Las Vegas. Nicknamed the Professor by other prisoners, Cohen was paid 45 cents an hour for tutoring in algebra and calculus. His incarceration, he says, was uneventful. Save the Night, 60 Minutes reran the segment, and other prisoners learned that the business he had co-founded was doing more than $100 million in annual revenue. After the 60 Minutes piece aired and re-aired, Cohen received fan mail from a viewer. The correspondent urged Cohen to consider a pregnancy due date betting service, an idea WSEX rejected out of hand. But the letter writer also had another suggestion. Why not convince the authorities in Antigua to sue the U.S. for violating world trade rules? The argument was fairly simple. The U.S. permitted bets on horse racing to be placed at off-track facilities. By permitting horse racing operations to take bets remotely and not offshore sportsbooks, the U.S. was giving preferential treatment to American businesses over foreign businesses, a violation of WTO rules. Cohen's attorney, Mark Mendel, was intrigued. He was no trade lawyer, but he convinced the Antiguan government to let him represent the country on the matter. With WSEX footing the legal fees, Mendel filed the case at the WTO in Geneva, and eventually won in 2005. Cohen, by then on probation in San Francisco, told an NPR reporter, "I was elated. Finally, some vindication. You know, in 50 or maybe even 10 years, they're going to look back at my case and say, 'We sent a man to prison for that? What? Are we nuts?'" But the U.S. government wasn't done. First, it appealed the decision, and a WTO arbitrator let the United States off the hook for any meaningful penalty. Then came the real hammer blow. In the fall of 2006, George W. Bush signed the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, UIGEA, the death knell for online poker and offshore sportsbooks. Then a decade into the job, Kyle was credited with expediting the UIGEA's passage through the Senate. Under UIGEA, strict banking restrictions were imposed on services like Western Union. Suddenly, they wouldn't process transactions between WSEX and its U.S. customers. Same for most credit card companies. Cohen says WSEX had to seek out less reputable payment processors. Terms were often larded with fees. Cohen recalls that a friend suggested they take bets via a newfangled virtual currency called Bitcoin. We thought it didn't make sense. Looking back, maybe that wouldn't have been a bad idea. Word started circulating among sports gamblers that WSEX didn't pay off winning bets promptly, and customers were having a hard time getting their money out. Our illustration shows an NBA-shaped logo, vault, with piles and piles of money that's not actually looking like it's going anywhere. It's just being stashed. The customer loyalty that WSEX had cultivated was fraying. As Cohen says flatly, we were being driven underground, and our reputation got dinged. Already devoting so much money to legal fees, WSEX revenues plummeted. By 2010, Antigua revoked the founding company's license. On Friday, April 19, 2013, the WSEX website officially shut down, citing inadequate capital resources. That same day, friends of Schillinger stopped by his condo to invite him to a party. Instead, they found his lifeless body on the floor next to a gun and a note stating he could not live with the shame and guilt of being unable to pay his customers or cover their funds. In Antigua, authorities downplayed Schillinger's death, referring to it simply as a shooting. To Cohen, it all felt so screamingly unfair, and he directed most of his anger at the U.S. government. So much so, he not only moved overseas after his probation, but renounced his U.S. citizenship. He returned first to Antigua, and then landed in Montenegro, where he oversaw a syndicate of online poker players. The business, he says, did not thrive, but a colleague introduced Cohen to his future wife. Even after WSEX shuttered and Schillinger died by suicide, Ware decided to remain a fugitive. He pinballed around the world, Argentina, Germany, Ireland, Montenegro, Brazil, working for various legal gambling businesses and sportsbooks. Finally, in 2016, he returned to the United States and pleaded guilty to the more than a decade-old charge. He was not sentenced to prison, and after serving probation, moved to rural Connecticut, where he lives with his partner, whom he first met when she worked answering phones for WSEX in Antigua. Like Cohen, he has applied for hundreds of jobs. He consults for digital marketing firms, but says, I'm still a convicted felon, and I still need to check that box. Even when he applied recently for the local volunteer fire department, he was afraid his application would be rejected. I like my quiet life here and my little house, he says, but when I came back to the States with nothing and have just been trying to rebuild, we all have to reinvent ourselves. McAllister, the former overseer of gambling for Antigua, is now based in Washington and consults for Trinidad and Tobago. The injustice of it, the whole thing was so cruel, still tears me apart every day. These guys were thrown under the bus. As for other players, Mary Jo White would leave the Southern District, returning to a job at the law firm of Debevoy & Plimpton. After serving as chair of the SEC under Barack Obama, she again returned to the firm. While perhaps most notably, she came under fire for representing the Sackler family as it faced lawsuits stemming from the opioid crisis. She also has booked significant business with the NFL, including her investigation from 2022 to 2023 into Dan Snyder, determining that the former Commander's owner withheld revenue from other owners and sexually harassed a former team employee. White, through her firm, declined comment. Debevoise itself did not respond to questions. After leaving the U.S. Senate in 2013, John Kyle ended up at the NFL's other law firm, Covington and Burling. In 2018, he was appointed to the Senate seat of the late John McClain. But after the term, Kyle returned to Covington, where, according to public filings, he recently earned $1.9 million as a lobbyist. Now in his 80s, he did not respond to a request for comment. Meanwhile, in the ultimate pivot, the NFL went from branding gambling as an existential threat to embracing it. In 2018, along with the other major sports leagues, the NFL encouraged the Supreme Court to overturn PASPA, which the court did that year, opening the door for states, 38 and counting, plus D.C., to legalize sports gambling. Now, of course, wagering is as much a part of the NFL tableau as tailgating. Gambling advertisements are everywhere. Team partnerships are common. The same league that not long ago turned down a Super Bowl commercial from Las Vegas Tourism now holds the Super Bowl there. And the same league whose high-powered law firm helped prepare a federal case against online sportsbooks earned millions last year from online gambling partnerships, not least because of the appeal of the in-game betting introduced by WSEX. An ocean away, Jay Cohen's previous life feels immeasurably distant. His Sundays were once devoted to taking bets and setting lines as the company he co-founded took in billions in action. Now, he has no interest in football, unable to name the two teams that played last season's Super Bowl. The normalization and stigmatization of online sports gambling in the United States is vindication that comes seated with a mix of anger and sadness. He resists the urge to wonder why, when sports gambling is still illegal in, say, Utah. Operators can transmit live betting data directly from Jazz home games without violating the same Wire Act cited in his case. Or why the U.S. government has sided with the Seminole tribe in its sports wagering dispute, supporting the notion that if the servers handling bets are located on tribal lands, it does not run afoul of the federal statute. And a recent Florida state constitutional amendment restricting casino gambling. Nor does he think about how much WSEX as first mover might be worth, given the market cap for DraftKings, more than $30 billion. Or what his life might look like had the NFL not flexed its muscle. Thousands of miles from the NFL's Manhattan offices, but in a voice still redolent of Long Island, he says, "It's like, you crush my business and you stole my idea. Please do one or the other. You shouldn't do both. It's like the game was rigged against us." That concludes the end of our two-part series by L. John Wertheim, Paradise Squashed. In the 90s, life was a breeze for the masterminds behind the site called World Sports Exchange. From Antigua, they were pioneering internet sports betting. Then the NFL rallied the United States government against them. Our next story takes us from Antigua to China. Chris Mannix has China's biggest hope. A decade after leaving his native land to embark as a professional career as a hard hitter, Zhila Zhang is making waves in the heavyweight division while drumming up interest in the sport back home. Our photographs are courtesy of Eric W. Rasko, and it's a two-page spread of Zhila Zhang's face and left glove. It shows his eyes, one on each page, the nose split down the middle, a very, very big hope, a very big photo of this gentleman, and a large red boxing glove in the forefront of the photo on one entire page. As if Zhila Zhang wasn't already intimidating. As if being 6'6" with Thanos-like fists didn't make your knees rattle. As if back-to-back knockout wins last year over granite-chinned Brit Joe Joyce weren't enough. On this particular mid-November day, inside a nondescript gun range in northern New Jersey, Zhang has his fingers wrapped around a Sig Sauer P365 XL. Guns, Zhang insists, were never his thing. And his purpose of owning one is not to look tough. His trainer, Sean George, introduced him to recreational shooting a few years ago. Kurt Lee, his co-manager and translator, who moonlights as a range safety officer, showed him the ropes. The first time he pulled a trigger, his hands trembled. "Very nervous," says Zhang. But there was something about the simplicity of it, the focus needed to hit a small target, the repetition required to get good at it. Soothing is how Zhang describes it. So a couple of times a month, Zhang drives to the range and shoots a box of bullets at paper targets hanging 25 feet away. It might be an unusual training technique, but Zhang is not your usual fighter. Like, what is a two-time Chinese Olympic heavyweight doing in suburban Jersey? For that, you have to go to Terry and Tommy Lane, co-founders of Lane Brothers Boxing. In 2009, the Chinese national boxing team began making sporadic trips to the United States for training camps. Eventually, the Lanes, then small-time promoters in Nevada, began hearing chatter about some of the talent, including Zhang, who punched his way to a silver medal at the 2008 Beijing Games. The Lanes linked up with Dino Duva, a veteran U.S. promoter who had built his relationship in China. Together, the trio formed Dynasty Boxing, negotiating with the Chinese government to turn pro a handful of fighters, including Zhang, and bring them to the United States. Duva, the former president of Main Events, was based in New Jersey. So in 2014, Zhang went there. Okay, so how is it that Zhang, 40 years old and a decade into his pro career, is one of boxing's best big men? For that, you have to go to George, a fringe cruiserweight who retired in 2009, at the urging of his manager, Duva's father, Lou. George decided to get into training. Lou invited George to a U.S.-China national team dual meet in New York and pointed out Zhang. "Watch this guy," he told George. "He's going to be a heavyweight champ." "He was huge," says George. The more George watched, the more he liked. Zhang had size, sure, but he also had speed, athleticism, slashing power. After the meet, the Chinese coaches invited George to a camp in the Poconos. "They like my philosophies," says George. With the 2010 Asian Games around the corner, the coaches asked George to come to Beijing to work with their top prospects. George liked China so much that when Zhang turned pro and moved to Jersey, George decided to stay behind. 3 years later, in 2017, Zhang asked him to become his head trainer, and George agreed. From afar, George had cringed at how Zhang was being developed. There was no plan, no visible signs of improvement. The only objective seemed to be to large Zhang's record with enough warm bodies until one of the top weights would pay a premium to face him. "Do you remember Nikolai Valuev?" asked George, referencing a 7-foot Russian who briefly held a heavyweight title. "That's how everyone was looking at Zhile, like he's a gimmick." Our first photo shows Zhang with his mouth screaming in triumph, both of his boxing gloves up around his own ears as he gives a "I am the champion" stance, while his trainer gives him a big hug, and it looks like this man's head only comes up to about the middle of the body, about the abdomen of Zhang. Zhang traveled to the UK for his first meeting with local hero Joyce, when he easily dispatched in 6 rounds last April. It was a London mauling. Back in New Jersey, George worked to fine-tune Zhang's skills, chin tucked lower, hands held higher. At the same time, not change him so much where he doesn't know how to use his feet, says George, because he's actually really quick on his feet, but you guys don't know yet. He has pretty good hand speed, but you guys are actually just noticing that now. What followed was a mix of success. 11 straight wins from September 2016 to November of 2020. And setbacks. A draw against Jerry Forrest in 21. A narrow decision defeat to Flip Herkovic in 22. Last April, Zhang was tapped to face Joyce. It was a showcase fight for the granite chin Joyce, the 2016 Olympic silver medalist who was next in line for a title shot and considered unknockoutable. Considered unknockoutable. Zhang, an 11-1 underdog, battered Joyce over 6 rounds until the referee mercifully stopped the fight. In the rematch 5 months later, about Zhang admonished Joyce's handlers not to take, he needed just 3 rounds to put Joyce on the canvas. "I warned them," Zhang says with a shrug. "Big mistake." Suddenly the sideshow was a star, only it wasn't sudden to Zhang's camp. "Nobody wanted to trust the process," says George. "Everybody thinks he just figured out how to fight. That's not the case. Zhilai knew how to fight a long time ago. He's a giant that just needed to be provoked." Zhang isn't sure where his size comes from. Both his parents were under 6 feet. His brother and sister, Zhang's the youngest of three, they're not 6 feet either. He's heard stories about his great-grandfather being big, but can't say for certain. "Maybe," muses Zhang, "some kind of genetic mutation." Our next photos in the ring are giant Zhang on the right, his opponent on the left, and Zhang is giving a right hook as he looks fierce and the other person looks very pained. Zhang was big, not just for his family, for his town. Zhang grew up in Shanghu, a rural county that sits on the line between Henan and Anhui in the eastern part of China. He wasn't athletically gifted, wasn't so athletically inclined either. When he was 12, his father, concerned about his weight, suggested Zhang try sports. Kayaking was popular. Zhang liked it, But the first time he squeezed a 6'1", 190-pound frame into one, he felt the water splashing into the sinking vessel as he paddled. His kayaking coach suggested boxing. Zhang didn't know a little about boxing. He knew nothing. China Central Television showed fights on only Sunday mornings, and Zhang wasn't watching. But there was something about the feeling of the gloves, the thwack of the heavy bag. "It just got me excited," says Zhang. After 2 weeks of training, he sparred with a provincial champion.
"I beat the crap out of him," says Zhang. "He was bleeding all over his face. That's when I realized I was actually pretty good."
Chinese officials did, too. In 1998, Zhang moved to Zhengzhou, the site of provincial training center. Success followed. A silver medal at the 2004 University Championships. A bronze at the World Championships in 07. In 08, Zhang claimed his silver medal at the Beijing Olympics. He began studying not just boxing, but boxers. Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield, Lennox Lewis. Not just their skills, but also their fortitude. Great heavyweights, when they fight into the last couple of rounds, they're all gassed out, but they're still throwing punches, says Zhang. At the end of the fight, it's all mental. That's when you see a fighting spirit. Shortly after the Olympics, Dino Duva was invited to Beijing to consult for the Chinese Boxing Federation. In Zhang, he saw not only talent, but also an unprecedented ambition. At the time, Chinese boxers didn't turn pro. Few of the country's athletes did. "When you're a national athlete in China, you get treated pretty well," says Duva. "You're supported by the government. They support your family. They give you bonuses and pay you well. But if you decide to make the move to become professional, they cut you off." Zhang, Duva says, wanted more. He had this determination. We have two photos of Zhang as he trains. The first one, he's in action, Garden State variety, at 6'6", 40-year-old fighter who speaks no English. Zhang stands out at the True Warriors Boxing Club in Paterson, New Jersey. You can't see the individual he's sparring against, but they're holding bats as though they're kind of using them to keep him as Zhang studies his movement of his hands. In the next one, Zhang's up against a large bag. It's a boxing bag, and he's got his hands wrapped around his own body, stretching out as he looks into the mirror. And the mirror is rather, as you might expect at a boxing space, it's kind of dirty. Duva says he really wanted to move on past being a Chinese national athlete and become a professional boxer. In the quarterfinals of the 2012 London Olympics, Zhang lost to Anthony Joshua, who would go on to be the unified heavyweight champ. A year later, after winning a championship at the National Games of China, Zhang retired from the national team at age 30, laying his jersey in the center of the ring after his final fight. Then, it was off to New Jersey. But before he decided to leave his wife and son in China, "It was very difficult," says Zhang, "but it was what I had to do." The early years in the U.S. were chaotic. Zhang's pro debut, says Tommy Lane, was a disaster. The original opponent fell out a week before the bout. The replacement went down 9 seconds into the first round. The Lanes and Duva clashed over how to best develop their fighter. Duva wanted to develop him into a big puncher whose power would be his draw. Dino saw Zhang as a Chinese primo carnera, says Terry. Duva insists he believed in Zhang,
but understood a fighter so new to the pro style needed to be brought along slowly. A few months after Zhang's debut, Dynasty Boxing went bust. "We ran out of money," says Jerry. The Lanes exited the business. Duva pivoted Zhang to Roc Nation, with Duva joining as an executive. Roc Nation, like many new promoters entering boxing with a bunch of money and no plan. Zhang continued to fight, but often at low-profile shows. When he did get opportunities, he stumbled. In 2015, Zhang, fighting under the undercard of Miguel Cotto's middleweight title defense against Canelo Alvarez, faced Juan Good. Zhang was knocked down in the fourth round, narrowly squeezing out a decision. "He looked like shit," says Duva. "His training, his diet, his living habits, they were all bad." The next year, George returned and addressed it, laying out a structured schedule and enlisting nutritionists. "He's a coach's dream," says George. "He'll do whatever you tell him. Not just listen, but he tries to understand it." In 2019, the Lanes returned to the picture, this time as advisors. Roc Nation announced it was exiting boxing, and the Lanes negotiated Zhang's release with Matchroom Boxing, which Duva had cut a deal with, becoming his promoter. For all the work George and his team of nutritionists did, maintaining a regimen during the pandemic was not easy. In March of 21, Zhang faced Forrest. He knocked Forrest down three times in the first rounds. In the second half of the fight, he ran out of gas, ultimately settling for a draw. Zhang says in the week leading up to the fight, he drank only one bottle of water, and afterward he was hospitalized for kidney failure, liver damage, and anemia. Fully recovered a year later, Zhang faced Hrgović, an undefeated former Olympic bronze medalist from Croatia. Hrgović had never been past the eighth round. Zhang took him 12, dropping a razor-thin decision. "He won," says George. "You'll never convince me otherwise." A few months later, Zhang got the call for Joyce. Cutting left hands did the job in the first fight. One thudding right did it in the rematch. "Now they know," says Zhang. "Chinese power is real power. It can put anyone down." The short answer to what a heavyweight boxer eats is, well, everything. Steak, chicken, different kinds of fish. During a recent visit to Jiangnan, a Chinese fusion joint Zhang frequents in Montclair, New Jersey, a plate filled with flat, oval-shaped meat arrives at the table. George slides a piece between a pair of chopsticks and asks Zhang to identify it. He always asks. In China, George was often offered food he could not identify. Horse, bull penis, snake blood. "Cow tongue," says Zhang. The chopsticks drop. "Nope," says George, "not eating that." There's a cheeriness to Zhang. He has stability, both in his career and with the people around him. Li, who has been with Zhang since 2010. "George," Zhang says, "is like a brother." In 2018, with his career stalled, Zhang considered retirement. A photo of Zhang with his fists raised above his head, one hand gripping roses. Zhang floored Russian Mirstayev of Kazakhstan in the quarterfinals en route to his super heavyweight medal in Beijing. Silver lining. Now, Zhang believes he has several good years left in him. His next fight will likely come in February on the undercard of the Tyson Fury Oleksandr Usyk heavyweight unification. A title shot of his own could come soon afterward. Which raises the question, can Zhang open up the Chinese market? His visibility is growing. Zhang has 2.3 million followers, China's equivalent to TikTok, Douyin. Both Joyce fights were streamed on Douyin, available for $1 as a pay-per-view. It got pirated more than it got bought, says Terry. But the number of views was in the tens of millions. In September, Zhang returned to China for the first time since the COVID-19 pandemic, concerned that no one would recognize him. Li hired a dozen actors to greet him. When Zhang exited the Hangzhou railway station, hundreds of fans were waiting for him. "No one was paying attention to me when I first turned pro," says Zhang. "But with my recent fights and the recent noise I'm making, it's significant. The recognition of boxing in China is tremendous. It's just not popular, not yet anyway. China has 1.4 billion people, but promoter Bob Arum, that doesn't mean anything. India has the same number of people, and you still couldn't sell a ticket to Mahatma Gandhi fighting for the title." In 2013, Arum signed Zhou Shiming, Zhang's Olympic teammate. The relationship was successful, with Zhao even winning a 112-pound title. But he failed to capture national interest. "The problem was, the guy couldn't effing fight," says Arum. "He won 2 gold medals, I don't know how, but he could not fight." "Zhang," Arum says, "is different. Heavyweights are the baddest guys in the world. And I think his ability is much greater than Zhao's was." The Lanes agree. They see Zhang leading a new generation. "We always thought he could be the Yao Ming of boxing," says Tommy. Under Armour signed on as a sponsor, and Baijiu, a popular Chinese liquor, could join them. Business people in the country have expressed an interest in bringing a title fight to the mainland. The Bird's Nest, Beijing's 91,000-seat stadium, is the dream, and the Lanes have been looking for young Chinese fighters to fill Zhang's undercard. "Zhang," says Tommy, "can be the godfather of Chinese boxing, a pioneer for future generations. The next Sugar Ray Robinson could be some 8-year-old from Shanghai who's never seen a boxing glove. They have the athletic talent pool. There's no reason it can't be. Perhaps even in the family." At the table, Zhang flashes a picture of his son, who still lives in China, and sees his dad a few times a year. His name is Jingxi, Mandarin for "respect the rules." But he's known to Zhang's U.S. contingent as Zach. Now he's 14 years old, 6'2", and weighs 200 pounds. There's no doubt where Zach's size comes from. But asked whether Zach boxes, Zhang shakes his head. "Likes school," Zhang says, "studies English, but hates sports." "Oof, that's one no, but there are still more than a billion to go." Our last photo is of Zhang in the ring. He's just knocked his opponent down. The caption, "Now they know who has 21 knockouts in 28 fights. Chinese power is the real power. It can put anyone down." That's our story by Chris Mannix, China's Big Hope. A decade after leaving his native land to embark on a professional career, hard hitter, Zhilei Zhang is making waves in the heavyweight division while drumming up interest in the sport back home. Our photographs have been courtesy of Eric W. Rasko. Next up in sports, we have Sports Illustrated Caitlin Clark. Caitlin Clark is leaving Iowa for the WNBA on her own terms. The Iowa star helped define what it means to be a star in today's college basketball landscape and will now seek new heights as a pro, by Emma Basileri. speaking with Sports Illustrated in an empty Carver Hawkeye arena over the summer, Caitlin Clark weighed the decision that hung over her upcoming basketball season. The Iowa Hawkeye star could make her senior year her last one in Iowa City. Or she could extend what had already been a historic, one-of-a-kind college run with a fifth and final season in 24-25. Part of the last class to have such a choice under the pandemic policy of the NCAA. Either I'm going to come back to something that I've really loved, or I could start my pro career, which was my dream ever since being a little kid, Clark said back in August, describing it as a really, really hard decision. She maintained that stance publicly over the months that followed. But as the season wore on, at least from the outside, it became harder to imagine Clark staying for that extra year at Iowa. What more did she have to prove in college basketball? As she put together another year of leading the nation in scoring, breaking records, selling out gyms, the answer seemed to be not much. That concept was not exactly new for her. From the beginning of her freshman season, Clark stood out from the competition, scoring more than any other player in the country, even then. But she commanded a different kind of attention now, a star with a singular, intense, gravitational pull. The result felt obvious. It was time for the Caitlin Clark Show to play new venues. On Thursday, she made that official. Clark announced she will forego her fifth year of eligibility and instead turn pro with the WNBA in April. While this season is far from over, and we have a lot more goals to achieve, it will be my last one at Iowa, Clark wrote in a statement posted to social media. I am excited to be entering the 2024 WNBA draft. Her post goes on to read, It is impossible to fully express my gratitude for everyone who has supported me during my time at Iowa, my teammates who made the last 4 years the best, my coaches, trainers, and staff who always let me be me, Hawkeye fans who filled Carver every night, and everyone who came out to support us across the country, especially the young kids. Most importantly, none of this would have been possible without my family and friends who've been by my side through it all. Clark is the presumptive number one pick in the draft in a way that makes the word presumptive feel gratuitous. The pick is held by Indiana Fever, meaning that Clark will stay in the Midwest, which she has called home all her life, and where the heart of her enthusiastic fan base lies. The jump from college to the pros is considerable, even for a player as generationally talented as Clark. There are no guarantees, but the opportunity here is tremendous. She'll join a roster that includes last year's number one pick, Aaliyah Boston, and the two of them should be an ideal pairing, with Clark in the backcourt feeding Boston in the post. They could make for an elite offensive duo, and it doesn't feel unreasonable to expect Indiana's first playoff appearance since 2016. And on-court success is but one of the benefits the franchise should expect from drafting a player like Clark, who's demonstrated a remarkable ability to generate hype, spark conversation, and draw in audiences. But all of that lies after the remaining college play in front of her. Clark's announcement comes ahead of number 6, Iowa's Senior Day, on Sunday, which is its last regular season game, a matchup against number 2, Ohio State. It's also a chance to avenge the Hawkeyes' overtime loss to the Buckeyes from January. That will be followed by the Big Ten tournament and then March Madness, where she will be chasing the one achievement she has not been able to capture at Iowa, a national championship. In declaring her plans, Clark has turned off a torrent of speculation that would have otherwise followed her every step of the way over the next month. She's also provided some clarity about how to frame the weeks to come. These will be Clark's last games in an Iowa uniform. She's done what she set out to do. As a recruit, her stated goal was taking Iowa to the Final Four, and she helped make that happen last year. But she also has done something that would have been much harder for anyone to imagine when she was an incoming freshman. Clark has felt, somehow, perfectly suited for her particular moment, coming along at just the right time in the arc of the women's game and the three-point revolution and the name, image, and likeness movement to become her own specific brand of national superstar. Even in Clark's earliest days at Iowa, watching her could trigger a sense that she was playing on the edge of something like history, and she was just waiting for the rest of the world to catch up. Now, as she announces the end of this stage of her career, it seems evident. The rest of the world has finally caught up. How could it not? She didn't leave it any other choice. A photo of Clark shows where she graced the Sports Illustrated cover. Caitlin Clark's amazing Iowa journey continues. This story has been courtesy of Emma Basileri. Caitlin Clark is leaving Iowa for the WNBA on her own terms. We'll end our broadcast with a little Charles Barkley giving congratulations to Patrick Mahomes after going 0-3 betting against the Chiefs in the playoffs. This story by Patrick Andres, March 1st, 2024, Sports Illustrated. On Inside the NBA, receiving the fateful guarantee of victory from Hall of Fame forward Charles Barkley is akin to the kiss of death. In 2021, for instance, Barkley went a staggeringly poor 10 for 25 on playoff guarantees. He did catch fire with 5 straight correct guarantees in the Eastern Conference Finals between the Bucks and the Hawks. It turns out that Barkley's lack of prognostication prowess is not limited to the NBA. On Thursday, Barkley conceded. He went 0-3. Betting against the Kansas City Chiefs in this year's NFL playoffs. And he congratulated quarterback Patrick Mahomes for his success. Pat Mahomes, number 1, you and tight end Travis Kelce and defensive tackle, undefined. I love you, coach. Andy Reid, congratulations, Barkley said. Yeah, I bet against you at Buffalo Bills. Yeah, I bet against you at the Baltimore Ravens, and I bet against you in the Super Bowl. I was 0-3. Three-time loser, Hall of Fame center Shaquille O'Neal chimed in. After a lackluster regular season by their lofty standards, Mahomes and the Chiefs beat the Bills 27-24 in the divisional round, and the Ravens 17-10. In the AFC Championship before downing the San Francisco 49ers 25-22 in overtime to win Super Bowl 58. That's Patrick Andres Charles Barkley congratulates Patrick Mahomes after going 0-3 betting against the Chiefs in the playoffs. A photo of Barkley dressed in a matching suit and tie with his hands very animated. As you can see, he's in the midst of telling a story, probably this particular story. That's all the time we have for this edition of The Sports Show. My name's Jane Woods. Thanks for joining me.